On this week's 51%, we'll speak with a filmmaker who walked the wards of Chinese hospitals to speak with young workers poisoned by the chemicals that went into making our cell phones.
One of the most tragic conversations I had is with a young girl who's been in the hospital for 2 years, having been paralyzed by N-hexane, and she said that she hopes that one day she can afford an iPhone.
We'll hear about a program to entice women into coding. And sure, the cookies may be good, but the Girl Scouts want to be known for a lot more than that. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
End of the day, factory whistle cries. Men walk through these gates with death in their eyes. And you just better believe, boy, somebody's gonna get her tonight. The work, and just the work in life. Cause it's the work, and just the work in life.
Over the summer, Apple announced it was eliminating benzene and N-hexane in the manufacture of its iPhones and iPads. A filmmaker says her unreleased documentary depicting the toxic chemicals' toll on young Chinese workers had something to do with it. Award-winning nonprofit executive and researcher Heather White had released on YouTube and Facebook scenes from her unreleased film, Who Pays the Price? The Human Cost of Electronics, mobilizing activists to pressure the tech giant. Her film profiles injured and chemically poisoned young Chinese workers who were laboring in factories that manufacture the world's leading electronics brands. Several of her subjects have been discarded by their factories after being diagnosed with leukemia from exposure to benzene, a solvent commonly used in polishing cell phone and tablet screens. Others suffered debilitating accidents from faulty machinery. White, previously a MacArthur Foundation and Ford Foundation grantee for her human rights work, filmed a large portion of the documentary with hidden cameras in Chinese hospitals. I asked her why she decided to make the film.
In 1997, I read an article in a Chinese newspaper that said that the government had recently established clinics for the care of paralyzed teenagers who had been working in factories and exposed to toxic chemicals in massive doses that were leading them to become both paralyzed, and many were also falling into comas. And they said the average age was around 18. And at the time I was working on labor issues, I was running a nonprofit organization I'd started called Verite. And I was very interested in finding out more about these clinics. They said that the government had had to step in because the factories were not giving the workers the compensation, and they weren't paying for their medical expenses. And so I had kept it in the back of my mind that I wanted to have a chance to follow up on that story from many years ago. And then finally in 2012, I received the funding to go to China and start doing some investigations about it, and began working with the videographer when I found that there were so many workers in hospitals that were dealing with occupational illness and disease, and also having lost their limbs from faulty machinery, all making electronics and cell phones. So that was really what got me started. And then the project took on a life of its own, and we were able to just continue filming interviews with workers, going to their homes, going to their villages in the countryside where they had come from. And now we've got over 100 hours of footage and launched a trailer in March that's up on YouTube to let the world know what's happening behind the scenes in the factories.
And it doesn't sound like, given what you just described, that you had a lot of difficulty in getting people to talk, or did you?
Most of the time people were willing to talk because they're involved in very difficult negotiations or struggles with the factory to try to get the reimbursement for their medical expenses and the coverage for their chemotherapy. They have a very difficult time even receiving from the hospital an occupational disease diagnosis, which is a confirmation that they received doses of chemicals in the workplace which were directly responsible for the leukemia or the illnesses that they're dealing with. In addition to leukemia, there are a lot of blood-related diseases and serious forms of anemia that people are finding they're contracting, in some cases, only within a few months of having worked at the factory. We have a group of 39 girls who are mostly teenagers, all from the same factory, and they, on average, had just worked at the factory for 2 to 3 months before they became paralyzed from N-hexane poisoning, which is one of the two chemicals that the film focuses on and are also the two that Apple announced that they're going to ban from the final assembly of their products in China, which was really a great victory for us and very gratified that the company chose to take leadership on this issue, and I'm hoping that the other electronics brands will also follow suit soon. We've asked for interviews on several occasions with Chinese officials to comment on what we've been finding in terms of occupational illness and injury, and in every case they've turned us down. So I'm still hoping by the time we finish the film we might have a chance to find someone who's willing to speak on the record, but so far they've declined. But they haven't prevented news about the film and comments that I've been making in the media from being published in the Chinese press, which has been great. We've actually been able to have quite a bit of coverage, and I'm really grateful for that as well. But the workers themselves do have their comments and their postings on social media removed generally within a half an hour if they criticize a company that they've been working for or if they talk about an illness that they've contracted at the factory and their efforts to try to get compensation and their frustrations. The censors do step in and remove those postings. We've done most of our filming just outside of Hong Kong in Guangdong province, which is in southeastern China on the coast. That's where the majority of the electronics sector has been based for the last 20 years. The suppliers, the subcontractors, a lot of the big factories that are producing for the global brands are all there. So I began with my colleague visiting hospitals randomly, the hospitals that are near the big factory zones, and just walking through the hospital wards and trying to identify workers who'd been working in electronics factories. And in general, they were willing to talk. They might not want to give the name of their factory or all the details, but in general, people would talk about where they'd worked, especially if they'd been working at Foxconn, which is Apple's largest supplier and is the biggest electronics manufacturer in China with over 1 million workers. In the Shenzhen area alone, they've got about 500,000 workers. And so those workers, when they get injured or in the hospital, they'll always talk about their employer and what they've been dealing with and trying to get their compensation.
Where does the film stand? What's to come?
We hope to have the film completed by March 1st, and we'll be entering film festivals and hopefully be able to make it available for broadcast television, because this is an issue that affects everybody. Everyone owns a cell phone. Even the workers themselves own cell phones. One of the most tragic conversations I had was with a young girl who's been in the hospital for 2 years, having been paralyzed by N-hexane, and she said that she hopes that one day she can afford an iPhone, that she hasn't been able to afford one yet, but that's one of her dreams. And the tragedy was that the factory confirms that they were producing iPhone components. And so, you know, everybody's all connected on this issue. The teenagers here, the teenagers over there who are making the products, and I think it's really important for people to let the manufacturers of the products they're using know that they care about these issues and they want better standards.
It's a bit of irony, though, to think, you know, when your film comes out that some of us will be watching it on iPads and other electronics where the components of those electronics were made. Exactly where the film you were talking about, you know, and what you're talking about in the film. It's just, it's kind of strange. And the question remains, will people pay a little bit more if they're manufactured elsewhere where it's just more expensive to produce it, but yet nobody's getting injured or sick?
In the case of these chemicals that I focused on in the film, we said in the trailer that a benzene-free device would cost consumers less than $1 more. And that's absolutely the case when Apple announced, for example, that they're removing those chemicals from assembly. They didn't announce a price increase because these chemicals are very cheap and so little of them is necessary for the production that it's you know, it's almost a cost that's not being calculated. That's not something that when people go over to buy a phone that they're even negotiating over, because this is just a solvent that the factory uses at its will, whatever kind they want. And benzene and then hexane happen to have been the cheapest.
I was unaware, you know, fully. I knew a bit of it, but is there anything else you wanted to point out or highlight?
Yes, so I'd like to point out that people don't know, and it's often difficult for them to know because these factories are thousands of miles away and the working conditions are hidden. And if workers have a strike even, it doesn't make the international news very often. But yes, they'll be watching it on their cell phones. I made the trailer with voiceover and dubbing of the interviews with the Chinese workers because I knew people would be watching it on their phones, and it's not as easy to read subtitle translation as to be able to hear their voices. And so we have voiceover. But for the film, we'll be using subtitles. The film can be watched on YouTube at Who Pays Film. The name of the film is Who Pays the Price, the Human Cost of Electronics. We have an active Facebook page where we're constantly updating any developments with Samsung, Nokia, other brands that have to do with worker illnesses and accidents, and just to let people know what's going on behind the scenes. In addition, if they're still interested after having seen the trailer. And we're also tracking the health issues to consumers who are using the phones, because the EPA acknowledges that there is a risk from using phones that are made with cadmium and lead and arsenic, benzene, etc. But studies have not yet been done to show what the risk to consumers is. So wherever I see that there's some information about that, we've been posting that on Facebook as well so that consumers can be aware, so they don't have to care only about the workers who are making the phone, but if they care about themselves and their children who are handling iPads and electronic devices, kids love cell phones, they can also check it out there and see what research is being done by some of the medical groups that are now taking a look at this issue.
And do you have an iPhone?
I do not have an iPhone. I did have an iPhone until I went to China and started doing the research for this project. And then I realized that I was going to have to give it up. One of the things I don't say in the film is that because Apple does the majority of its production in China, they're different from Samsung. Samsung knows its supply chain. They've got a lot of production in South Korea, but the subcontractors in the electronic zone in Shenzhen and Dongguan are in so many cases working on Apple products, and Apple doesn't even seem to know about it. They're not listed in their supplier responsibility report, and they're absolutely everywhere. Almost no worker that we interviewed didn't have some connection back to Apple and iPhones. So at that point I realized that I was going to have to switch out my iPhone for another product, and I went for an LG phone because we didn't find LGs to be connected to the occupational illness issue as much as some of the other brands.
That was Heather White, producer and co-director of the yet-to-be-released documentary, Who Pays the Price? The Human Cost of Electronics. Scenes can be found on YouTube and Facebook.
Invariably, how would I pass this? Well, my coder girl grants me root access. Basically, she's a certified A+. Yo, what's more than just tech with lust? Feels like my first hello world, cause she's my coder girl. Man, I had to dedicate this one to my coder girl. I'll put it like this so you can understand. She makes me want to update to be a better man.
When you think of a computer programmer, who comes to mind? A white guy in a hoodie and jeans? Maybe, for some. Well, a new Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit called Code for Progress is trying to change that. They're working with a cross-section of people traditionally left out of the tech world, women, minorities, and people with disabilities, to name a few, to teach them how to code. Lauren Ober sits in on a class to see the new faces of tech.
If the world is divided into two distinct camps, digital natives and digital immigrants, Terry Acker is most definitely a member of the latter. The grandmother of seven came of age when the only phones available had cords and a finger wheel. High-tech meant a television that had color or a radio that could fit in your pocket. So it's kind of a big deal that at 51, Acker is learning to code every day from 9 to 5.
Classes have been going pretty good. It's not as easy as I thought, but it's good.
Acker, who lives in Anacostia, is a fellow at Code for Progress, which is teaching people who have traditionally been overlooked by the tech community how to write computer code. And basically, the folks who have been excluded are everyone but white men. Latinos, people of color, disabled people, seniors, LGBT people, the list goes on. Michelle Fox is the managing director at Code for Progress. This is the first year for the initiative, which is the brainchild of activist Dirk Wiggins. With his flat cap and waxed handlebar mustache, Wiggins looks the part of tech geek. But Fox says Wiggins recognized that everyone else in the field pretty much looked like him as well.
We're leaving a lot of talent on the table. We're leaving a lot of possibilities on the table because we're not bringing in people from different backgrounds, different life experiences who might be able to inform the work in a really different way.
And that's kind of a problem. Because
what we've heard from a lot of the folks who applied to the program is that they never thought that they could be a coder.
So by recruiting diverse participants, Code for Progress is trying to introduce new ideas to the tech sector. It's a subtle form of activism, which makes sense since social justice is a huge part of the organization's mission. The program works like this. For 3 months, a dozen fellows take intensive coding classes and then get paired up with community nonprofits to help create technology for them. After their residency, the learning continues with mentorships and career counseling. Bobby Joe Smith III is one of the fellows.
I really get excited every day to come into the program because I know that I'm going to come away with one more piece to being able to build the app that I want to build.
Smith is Lakota and a member of the Cheyenne Sioux River tribe. He spent part of his childhood on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. Before arriving in D.C., his tech experience was limited.
I took a computer science course at Middlebury College, and which did not go very well, to be honest.
But that didn't put him off tech. He had bigger ambitions than just getting a good grade.
Part of what interested me in this program is I started seeing Native communities using tech to help organize around issues that they care about, whether that's bringing our culture online to be able to share across the country, no matter where Native people are, to movements like the Idle No More movement in Canada, and gaining support online through organizing in that manner.
Smith and his classmate Terry Acker are both full of ideas about the apps they want to develop. But first, they have to get through coding class.
First things first, y'all.
Alia Rahman is the lead instructor for the program. She's a coder, an organizer, and the kind of teacher any adult learner would love to have. She's patient, funny, and perhaps most importantly, she's respectful of her students' differences.
All right, quick review, and the way that I type that with upper and lowercase stuff is called what?
Camel case.
Case. We get in there. We had camel back earlier. We had camel cap. Yeah, camel case. We're getting there. Dromedary.
The fellows are in the beginning stages of learning the programming language Python. Rahman starts the lesson with an analogy.
Here's a question for you. In a movie, in TV, in a play, what is a script? Who's ever been in a play? That includes if you were like 7, it's fine. Me too, I was in Mary Poppins. I was a nanny, which is kind of weird. So what did you use scripts for?
They go on to discuss how a script in Python acts just like a script in a movie. Okay. It provides a set of directions. Everyone in the class gets it. Rahman's techniques win high praise from students like Terry Acker.
She makes it plain for us. I mean, we even had a lesson where she was like, okay, this is like we're putting together a peanut butter jelly sandwich, you know, because that's what coding is like. You fit the pieces together, and it made it all come home.
And knowing how to fit all the pieces together in tech makes all the difference. I'm Lauren Ober.
One place you'll see a lot of female faces is the Girl Scouts, which continues to guide and educate young women on leadership. In this Focus on Education report, WBFO's Eileen Buckley visited the Girl Scouts of Western New York headquarters, where the organization serves 20,000 girls across the region.
It encourages me to be more confident with myself, and it just makes me realize all the things that women have done.
Mara Skeevy is a high school junior at Niagara Wheatfield. She started in the Girl Scouts at the age of 5 as a Daisy. Skeevy says she's remained a Girl Scout because of all the skills and opportunities she's gained.
And Girl Scouts is like actually one of the things that keeps me going through school. Like when I'm having a bad day in school, I'll just be like, oh, I have Girl Scouts tonight, or I'm going to do a thing with Girl Scouts.
Kyla Miller agrees with Skeevy. She's a junior at Williamsville North High School and also started as a young girl as a scout.
It's just been a changing experience being able to grow up as a Girl Scout.
Both Miller and Skeevy conduct many hours of volunteering within our community.
Where have you volunteered?
The Weinberg campus. For the elderly, mm-hmm. I've helped out there.
Well, I've gone to soup kitchens, Friends of the Night people. I've done the sleep out for the homeless. And I helped out at the hospice, 5K Dash. I served water.
Where we live, where we play, where we meet every day, growing stronger than we ever dared.
For more than 102 years, this organization has been providing volunteerism and leadership skills. In 2012, it celebrated 100 years with the theme Ignite.
Ignite the world on fire, it's love. Starts with a spark.
First of all, I think when you talk about education, it's always the piece of believing that you can do it, right? So it's the piece of self-esteem, and that's what we do. We create that environment for girls.
Cindy Odom is CEO of the Girl Scouts of Western New York. The organization is well beyond what some citizens might believe is just about selling Girl Scout cookies each season.
They think about us and they say we're cookies, crafts, and camp. And we are cookies, crafts, and camp, but those are just delivery systems. What we're about is building girls of courage, confidence, and character who make the world a better place. And we use cookies, crafts, and camp, again, as I said, just as a vehicle to do so. So we're very relevant.
And so relevant with today's issues, it has a program addressing bullying called Be a Friend First.
Number one, so people can identify it. Because a lot of times kids don't understand that either they're either supporting somebody who may be a bully in a way or being bullied. And so one is the identification. And then the other part that the program teaches is what to do. You know, how do I deal with this? What do I say if I'm being bullied, if I see someone being bullied? Part of that programming is being relevant and moving our programming and our delivery system around issues that are facing girls today.
The organization relies on successful women leaders in various fields and industries to help demonstrate leadership in their careers.
Biggest challenge for you in the leadership role you have here?
I would say the economy. I don't think we're shy with talent as it relates to staff or as it relates to our volunteers who, again, make Girl Scouts really happen, or our girls. I think it is really the economy that, you know, as far as funding, that we struggle like every other nonprofit.
How do you continue to recruit young women to be Girl Scouts, and starts at probably a young age?
It really, it starts with our leaders, I would say that, our volunteer leaders who work with girls. You know, they are heroes. It also starts with the girls. I mean, they are our best advertisers, marketers. They are they talk to their friends.
The opportunities you get from Girl Scouts, you really can't get anywhere else. I met so many genuine people, amazing people from Girl Scouts that I never would have met if I never did this. And just go for it.
What would you say to someone that's not a Girl Scout? How would you recruit?
I definitely think that it's a great idea to join Girl Scouts because you get the connection with your troop. You get to help out around your community, which is really nice. You get to see like how other people live, and it's just like nothing else.
Both Miller and Skeevy's Girl Scout vests are filled with badges of achievements. They're now working on their highest level, the Gold Award. They must identify a new issue, conduct research, and execute a plan.
I'm hoping to help out at an SPCA shelter and set up an obstacle course for the animals.
But I want to do something for the hospital and just like give them books and maybe start a program there.
From daisies to brownies to Girl Scout ambassadors and lifetime members, Girl Scouts are proud of their traditions and future endeavors. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
We are the Girl Scouts, the Army Girl Scouts, and wherever we may be.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1326.